I'm talking with Anne Mitchell from ISIPP, and we're going to talk a little bit about the state of email today and some of the things that Anne's seen going on down there. She's right there in the trenches of getting email through and has had quite a history of working with email. Anne, welcome to the call. If you could tell us a little bit about yourself and your background, and then we'll go ahead and get started, that'd be great.
Well, Adrian, thank you so very much for having me. It's always a pleasure to work with you, and I'm glad to be back. And a little bit about myself. Well, I currently run ISIP, which stands for the Institute for Social and Internet Public Policy. And we have an email accreditation program called Surety Mail, which we use to help ensure that legitimate email senders are able to get their mail through to the inbox. And that was born of my original roots in the email industry, which is actually on the anti-spam side. I was originally in-house counsel and the director of legal and public affairs for the very first blacklist known as the MAPS RBL. And so my background is very much helping to make sure ISPs don't have to deal with email that people have not requested, also known as spam. But in the course of my work, I have also become very involved in helping to make sure that legitimate vendors are able to get their mail through to those ISPs. And that was because at a certain point in time, a quite pivotal point in time, I became almost painfully aware that despite the fact that the ISPs and email senders, email marketers, et cetera, seem to be at odds, even now, back then, years ago, certainly it was much more so. Despite all that, I became aware that really they wanted the same exact thing, and they were actually on the same side. And that thing that they both wanted was to not send or deliver email to people who don't want it, but to make sure that the people who do want a particular piece of email get it, that it gets through. So that, in a nutshell, is my background. That's what I do now.
Okay. I've got a lot of technical questions to ask you, but do you want to just tell us a little bit about where the industry is at? I mean, the company that you were CEO of for a while, Hades, was just bought by ReturnPath. You want to talk a little bit about what that means?
Well, sure. So I was one of the original founders of Hades. And Hades was originally founded as a company that was intended to help distinguish spammers from legitimate email senders and, in fact, to then sue the spammers using copyright and trademark law. And during my tenure there as CEO, Hades sort of evolved into primarily a company that would allow legitimate email senders to distinguish their mail from spam, which then in turn would allow the ISP to quickly identify the legitimate mail, send it on, and then they could turn their attention and resources to the bulk of the balance of mail, which was, of course, spam. I left Hades about a year after it was founded, and that was in, I believe, 2004 that I left, and had not had any relationship with it between now and then, other than to occasionally have people come to me, tell me stories about how it was doing, or to have people I'd hired in come to me to, you know, talk to me. And at the time, at present day, up until really the announcement yesterday, there were three primary, what I would call full-service email accreditation companies. And by email accreditation, what I mean is what we do at Surety Mail, which is working with an email sender and then vouching for them to the ISPs and spam filters. Well, these are good guys, they're doing the right thing, they're not sending spam, they're sending mail that's been requested, and you should deliver their email to the inbox. And the ISPs appreciate that because that means that they don't have to turn resources checking this mail. In other words, they don't have to run it through their whole gamut of spam filters just to determine at the end, oh, this wasn't spam to start with. This way they can just put it right in the inbox and again, to put those resources to dealing with the real spam. So at the time, up until yesterday, there were three of us. There was Hades, again, which I had found and then left a year later. There was our Surety Mail service and then ReturnPath, which is the sender's full service. And by full service, I mean we work with all of the different ISPs. We offer sort of a suite, if you will, of different services all related to email deliverability. We offer delivery inbox monitoring, so you can see if your email is getting delivered into the major ISPs or not. We offer email client rendering, which means that, you know, you can take your email, your creative that you're about to send out, and see how it will be rendered by 20 different email clients, so you know how it will look when someone at AOL reads it, and how it will look when someone at Hotmail reads it, and what it will look like in Outlook, and even on a couple of different mobile devices. So we offer that. And all of the three services, we're offering much of these same sorts of services. And then just sort of a side note, there's a company called Goodmail, which is slightly different. And what they do is they work with some of the ISPs. They basically put a little widget in your email that displays at the end that sort of says this email's been certified by Goodmail. But they only work with ISPs that actually are set up to have the infrastructure to accommodate that widget. And you can only send mail if you're certified with Goodmail by either using one of their MTAs or a vendor. So they're not really full service in that same way. They don't offer those other services. But I mentioned them because often their name comes up as well, and I didn't think I was flipping them. So there were three. There was Hades, ourselves, and ReturnPath. And so what this means, to get back to your question, is now there are two. There, because Hades is actually sort of being incorporated into ReturnPath. And I read...
Is the hold still in Hades?
Yes, I was. And that's a very interesting question that everyone seems to want to know the answer to. Yes, I, of course, had vested a year's worth of stock. However, it's no secret at this point, because there have been articles written in the past 24 hours that bring this to light, that Hades was sold for a pittance. I am not at liberty to say whether that pittance covered the debt which they were servicing, but I can say, because it is already been out there publicly, that no one with any stock got anything.
So I thought you were going to be retiring to the Caribbean on your own island that you bought.
Well, I still do that, but I'm very happy to say that our Surety Mail accreditation service and generally ISIT is doing extraordinarily well. So if I do it back to the Caribbean, it will be for the fruits of my own labor here, and of course, the company, not just me, you know, your wonderful staff. It will be a function of the current company, not my saga hideous. Let me say this. This is very critical. Not that I think necessarily it's important for your particular listeners, you know, they may or may not care how I feel about the ultimate disposition of habeas, but it's important for me to say this. And I said it in an interview, and I like to say here, because we're on the subject. People wondered how I feel about what was originally my baby, habeas, being acquired by what, in essence, the competitor. And I'm really very pleased. For one thing, habeas also had become a competitor, and in fact, I think they saw us quite seriously as a competitor and felt that perhaps we were a challenge to their model. On the other hand, they also had copied some things we had done once we came up with some innovative features, and I had anticipated that, and so I took that as a compliment. So we were a competitor, but also an acknowledged, you know, innovator there. But in any event, I feel very good about habeas being acquired by ReturnPath, primarily because when I founded or co-founded habeas, it had a great deal of potential. And during the time I was there, it had evolved in a direction that really held promise for both sides of the equation, both the email receivers, the ISVs and filters, and the email senders for getting legitimate mail delivered. And as I've been quoted as saying in an interview, the habeas that ReturnPath acquired was not the habeas that I founded.
All right, must have changed a lot over the years. Look, actually, this is ties into where I want to ask you some questions, because there's innovation coming up in the email space. There's I haven't been tracking it that closely in the last year or so, but I know there's things like SPF and domain keys. Those kinds of protocols are taking hold, where the email can be authenticated based on domains and things like that. And given that habeas as one of the major players in the authentication space has been acquired for not an entirely large sum of money, does that put some sort of level of indication as to the importance of the space? I mean, how important today really is accreditation, given that we have all of these other sorts of protocols coming along for authentication?
It's extremely important. And let me just finish, please, what I was saying that was critical, and then I'll address that. And that was, I just wanted to say that I'm very pleased that ReturnPath acquired habeas, because I know the people at ReturnPath, and they are stand-up people, and I know they'll do the right thing. So I'm very comfortable with habeas now being in their hands. I just wanted to get that out there, because that's really what people wanted to know when they were asking the question. Now, about authentication and accreditation, you know, I don't know if you've been privy to any of the discussions, any of the mailing lists or what have you, involved in the development of the authentication standards, or indeed any standards. If you ever sat in on any of the IETF working groups, then you know that every great idea has its year. And I don't mean it lasts a year. I mean, it takes it that long to get to a point where people can agree about anything about it. And so there are some promising authentication mechanisms out there, but there's by no means widespread, let alone universal adoption for any of them. Now, SPF has been around for how many years now? And we have people come to us every single day applying to be accredited who not only don't have SPF set up, and they know they probably should, but they have no idea how to do it. And in fact, just this week we launched a service where we will set up your SPF and domain keys for you, because so many people have no idea how to do it. So the adoption by the actual people who need to use it, the end UP email senders, there should not be uptake to even get close to universal for any of these mechanisms. So they're very important, and any upcoming system will also be very important. And when I say very important, I mean there are huge ISPs that if you are not publishing SPF or domain keys, you're probably not going to get your email delivered into those ISPs, or at best you're going to get into their junk folder. So it's extremely important. But despite that, the message and the adoption just haven't followed. So the technology, the innovations are important, but they do not, and I would say, you know, unfortunately, obviate the need for accreditation. And when
but
I say...
But if people are adopting free things like SPF and domain keys, why would they be more likely to adopt authentication and like paid services like yours?
Because we take care of everything for them. For the most part, the typical email sender, and I would say the majority of email senders, with, you know, the sort of rare exception, some of the very large ESPs who had their own in-house people, the typical email sender really doesn't know how to go about fixing problems they have with deliverability. You know, they don't know how to set up their SPF. They don't know any of those things, even those basic things, and they especially don't know how to, and probably are not in a position to, develop the relationships that they need to with their counterparts at all the ISPs. Whereas the email accreditation programs, ourselves and ReturnPath both, already have this relationship with each of the ISPs. So, for example, Adrian, you know, if you suddenly woke up tomorrow and found that all of your email had been blocked at AOL or Yahoo, or even just if it started going into the junk folder, would you know what to do? What would be the first thing you do when you realize that?
Call Ann Mitchell. No, I'd send her an email. I personally realized a while ago that email is too hard, even for, and I think I have a moderate understanding of it, and so I do my email on Google applications now, and I use mailing list service then to deliver my list email. So in those situations, I have people to raise it with on either side, and then they, the people that are more educated on this than me can get in and solve the detail.
We've seen that exactly. Google has just answered your question. That's answered your question, is that people want someone who already got the contact and already knows how to do this to do it for them. And in reality, for most situations and most vendors of any size, it's more cost effective to do so. Certainly, you know, we are extremely affordable. And if you think about what your time is worth, and if you think about the learning curve, and once you learn how to do all those things, and once you've made all the connections with the ISPs and spam filters, if in fact you can, then there's still time, once you learn all that, that it takes to apply that every week, every month, every day, what have you. So from pure cost analysis, it's much more cost effective to pay someone to do these things for you and to make sure the email gets delivered. And of course, let's make no mistake, for many, many companies now, email is their financial lifeblood. If their mail's not getting through, they're not earning money.
Right. So if I come to you, so let's say I'm like some people might want to use a service like ExactTarget, which has fairly high rates on a per CPM basis to deliver email. I could then have all my mail housed internally on my own mailing list software and handle the deliverability myself with you guys as the backstop to get the mail through. And so then, if I wake up one morning and my mail's not getting into Yahoo, I can call or I can email you guys and you guys will look into it. Is that basically how it works?
Well, now if you're using ExactTarget, then your mail is going out through their IP address. Now, I'm happy to say that ExactTarget actually is accredited with us, so you should have no trouble if you're using ExactTarget. But generally speaking, of course, all primarily, it's changing a little bit now, but for, you know, overwhelmingly still, email reputation is based on the reputation of your IP address, the IP address from which your email flows. So if you're using an email service provider, that is ExactTarget, and of course there are many other fine email service providers as well, then your email deliverability is keyed directly to the reputation of the IP address at that email service provider through which your email goes. Now, many email service providers, particularly many that work with us because we really urge them to do this, will give you your own IP address so that only your mail is going out through that address. But with many other email service providers, your mail is going out through the same IP address as 100 other companies, and if any one of those companies sends out a spam run, suddenly your mail is going to get blocked too because it's going through the same source.
They're monitoring that. But so let's say if I'm using ExactTarget, and ExactTarget's managing all the mail for me and handling the deliverability, and then I go using my own internal mail service, is that where I can have you then certify and manage my IP addresses, and so that if problems come up with my IP addresses, you then go and sort that out with the ISPs? Is that how it works?
Essentially, yes. So for and just to clarify, what you're saying is, you're using an email service provider such as ExactTarget, and then for some reason you choose to stop using them and to send your mail out through your own mail server. Yes, that's exactly one of the times when you'd come to us. Ideally, you would come to us as you were making that decision so that we could counsel you on how to start out right from the beginning doing everything right, because it's so much easier to start with no reputation and then build it up than it is to start having to first rehabilitate your reputation because you've unwittingly done something wrong. And I have to tell you, and I don't know if you read my, we have an email deliverability blog, again, emaildelivered.com, where that's what we talk about every day, is the things to do right, the things to do, you know, that can be done wrong that can affect and impact your email deliverability. And quite relatedly, today's post is actually about how just the content you choose can either cause your email to be delivered that should or go right into the junk folder. So ideally, you come up with it makes an enormous difference.
What percentage of the overall importance would you place on the content versus IP addresses and everything else?
Well, you're going to be glad to hear that I'm not an accountant when I tell you that I would say it's about 90% of the IP address and about 90% of content. Which, of course, you say, how could that possibly be? And that's why I'm not an accountant. But let me explain. It's not an aggregate. Primarily, in terms of, you know, if you look at the IP address, is it good? You look at the contents of it, it's rather a series of steps. The IP address reputation is what will get you past the initial deck. In other words, if your IP address is on a blacklist, your mail never even make it in the door at the ISP. But once your mail does make it in the door, then you have to run all the spam filters, which look at the content and the other things. So both are necessary, but neither alone sufficient in terms of getting your mail delivered.
That's interesting. I thought that content had become much less important, and I thought we were doing a better job on filtering based on IP addresses and stuff like name keys now, and so that's what they mainly look at. I guess I was pretty wrong.
Well, here's, you know, I think you're probably not wrong, because I think you're probably talking about something slightly different than I'm talking about. Or maybe we're talking about a sort of a bifacial sort of thing. It is true that the decision about whether to accept email at all into a receiving system is still based in large part on IP address and authentication. But again, once it's accepted in, rather than block or bounce, the decision as to whether it's going to get delivered to the inbox or the junk folder is extremely key to content. So you might have been talking about block or bounce versus junk folder. I'm talking now about junk folder versus the inbox.
Right. I get it. Okay. Let's do some questions. Actually, to that point then, I'm interested in how Google Acts generally does a pretty good job with its spam filtering. I get about 2,000 spam every day now, and you know, it keeps increasing. If you buy Fox and spam, I'd definitely buy them because it just seems to go up and up. They do a really good job in filtering, and my guess is they're doing some kind of collaborative filtering to keep mailing out of the inbox. Do you know anything about how Google Acts filters?
I know pretty much what everyone else knows, which is a great deal of speculation, very little confirmation, but it's educated speculation. And I would agree. You know, of course, they have Gmail from which to draw, and every time you click at something as spam, if, you know, 100,000 other people click the same thing as spam, it only makes sense they would use that data to educate and inform their own spam filtering decisions. Now, again, no one has actually ever confirmed that, but it only makes sense. Interestingly, however, I will say that their false positive rate is not stellar. It's not awful. There are places they're worse. But, you know, of course, and I think we've talked about this in the past, that, you know, the better and more effective your spam filter is, the more likely it is to also gain a spam, you know, identify spam mail that really isn't spam that you really want. And that can have some really dire consequences, particularly for transactional email. Not so much for bulk email. You know, the reality is that if you don't get a particular issue of a newsletter that, you know, 500,000 other people are also getting, it's unlikely that you're going to be terribly impacted by that in any negative way. But if, on the other hand, you don't get a notice of an appointment or a confirmation of travel arrangements or, again, something that's a transactional email, it can be absolutely devastating. And we've heard stories of, you know, lawyers who have missed court dates to the detriment of the clients because their spam filter ate the hearing notice that had come from the court.
That's interesting. I mean, the way I do that, handle it with Google, is I do a keyword search for my first name and last name and then some other related keywords and things that I'm doing. And I search that on my spam folder once every couple of days and then pull out what comes out and then the rest gets deleted. I don't find too much that way. I know I do miss some messages, but in general, I haven't missed any court dates.
But you know of. Well, and see, that raises a good point, which is also a point that's raised every time we talk about the court date story, which is, it's almost, well, I would say, speaking as a lawyer now, and now that people are on notice, in the legal context, I would say it almost rises to malpractice to not check your spam filter if you know that your local court sends notices by email. And the sort of meta point there is that no matter how good a spam filter is, you're still going to have to go through your spam. Because
well,
you're going to email
it. I'm getting 2,000 a day, so I'm not willing to do that.
But you are looking, by looking through it and checking it. You're still doing a form of checking it. You're doing a sort of a more high level form by doing your search.
And that suggestion to you, I sent that suggestion into Google, which they received but didn't act on. And that is that all of the services should enable you to specify some keywords that you're looking for goes into junk mail, and then automatically give those as whitelisted into the inbox. And that way, if users can specify the keywords that they're looking for, that's going to reduce the spam mail, and it's also something that spammers aren't going to be able to figure out, and if they do, then you can change those keywords. And given that you know some of the right people, maybe you can start mentioning that sort of thing so that they do that.
And that's a very interesting idea. It's not, you know, I mean, in native spam filtering, you know, some of the email clients, you can already do that. But you're absolutely right that for the ones that are web-based or you know, off-site, that's a very interesting idea. And you're also right that spammers are doing it, but...
Yeah, it'll get game, but it's hard to game when you can set your keyword yourself. But
right.
Yeah. Anyway.
Now, I have a question for you.
Tell me.
You mentioned that you mine your spam folder by searching for your name, and often spammers will have your name because they've purchased the list. And so I'm just wondering if you have found, you know, do you find that search turned up many things that are actually still spam, and do you sort of just look at them and discuss and say, wow, I can't use my name. Bad person.
No, they don't tend to have both my first name and my last name in spam. And in the number that comes up, it might, out of the 2,000 I got that day, there might only be 10. And so then that's a quick read.
Okay.
So I guess those have to be scanned manually. Yeah, good point. Because I wouldn't want all those to get in the inbox. But the volume's a lot lower.
Right. Because it's only a certain, you know, section of spam that also uses your real name.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, good point. So I guess there may be a third level. I mean, my spam volume is getting very high, and I can't process all that manually. The other thing that I wanted to ask you about is the different mail services. So like Hotmail, Google Apps, Yahoo, and then AOL, I guess, would be covering the big four. Who would you say is doing the best job at processing and filtering spam?
Processing and filtering spam, keeping it out of the inbox of their users, or processing and filtering and keeping it from being sent out to others?
For the user side, so doing the best job at blocking spam, and then also not having false positives.
I have to say that Google does a pretty good job. Now, you're talking Google Apps, and I'm talking Gmail. I have not personally worked with Google Apps, but, of course, they are built in to some extent on the same platform, as far as I know, at least. So I can say that Gmail does a pretty darn good job of keeping the spam in the spam folder. Their false positives are not awful. They're not great, but they're not awful. Okay. AOL, we hear very few complaints about.
So your number one would be Gmail and number two would be AOL?
I think so. But, you know, it always changes. And part of what informs that is, you know, every user has a unique experience because they're receiving a unique mail stream.
Right.
So if you're if you have an AOL account and you're signed up to a lot of newsletters that have to deal with, herbal products, you know, you're going to tell me that the false positive rate is absolutely appalling because they're all going to go in your junk folder.
Right.
On the other hand, if you're maybe sort of an older retiree and really all you're using your email account for is communicating with the kids and you do very little commercial transactions online, so you're not really expecting to receive anything that's bulk or transactional, you're going to tell me that, boy, AOL is wonderful because they never get it wrong. So even there, it's really pretty hard to quantify it, and everything is anecdotal.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I was actively testing different mail services a few years ago. I used a lot of tagged email addresses, so I could tag them and send them into the trash. Since I've moved to Gmail or Google Apps, they now, all those filterings are now gone, but Google Apps is actually just classifying them all themselves, and they're doing a really good job. I was a little stumped. Mm-hmm. I was going to get overwhelmed with spam, but they're actually getting it most of the time right, like 99.5% mm-hmm. right.
Yeah. Not much surprised to hear that.
Now, you mentioned briefly, and we should talk about that, you're a lawyer and you've been involved with the legal side of CAN-SPAM, and you in fact helped author some of the CAN-SPAM law, is that correct?
That's correct.
I know that there's some changes happening in the law with regard to email, and I know that could be a long topic in itself. Maybe if you could just tell us a little bit of what's happening there. My impression is that basically it's changing almost nothing. Is that correct, or am I misguided?
No, I'm not sure I understand the question. So are you saying that despite having the laws and new laws or revisions of the law that the spam landscape is still the same?
No, the legal perspective, like CAN-SPAM, the update that's coming through CAN-SPAM is it either happened or it's about to happen?
No, actually, it changes quite a bit. It has, and actually, I'm going to make sure that I don't misspeak, so just hang on just a minute here, because what I want to do is pull it up so I have it right in front of me so I don't misspeak or forget. But there are sort of four primary new changes, if you will, to the law. And by far the most dramatic. Let me start with the simplest. First of all, it clarified, and so in this way, you're right, that the disputed aspect doesn't really change much. You know, one of the things about CAN-SPAM was that it required that you put a physical mail address in each and every bulk or commercial bulk email that you sent. And when that first was enacted, we had people coming to us with all up in arms and very concerned because what they wanted to know was, does this mean we actually have to put our physical address where we sit in our office, or is it okay you a post office box if it's a legitimate post office box at which we really get mail? And our advice then at that time was, and that came from my legal background and knowing how the legal system works generally and knowing also what a monumental task the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, had in going after spammers, our advice was, look, if you're doing everything else right and you choose to use a post office box as your mailing address in your CAN-SPAM compliant mailings, the FTC is not going to come after you for that. They have much more important things to do than to go after someone who's really trying to comply and do everything right just because they put in a PO box. Yeah, they have much more important fish to fry and not
the resources. In theory, we're now supposed to put in a physical address where we're sitting at the time we send an email.
Well, excuse me?
In theory, we're supposed to put the physical address where we're sitting when we send an email.
Well, in theory, at the time, that was certainly how it could be read, but it was gray. And so one of these clarifications that came down this past month was that, yes, in fact, you may use a post office box. So what we had told people, it basically just confirmed. So it's no longer theory, and it's confirmed you can use a PO box as long as it really is your PO box, but you exercise control and you really go there and check the mail. Now, the next thing that came up that was clarified or amended this past month was that, you know, and everyone already should know, you're required under CAN-SPAM to remove an email address from your mailing list within 10 days of receiving that request, the request to opt out. And many people will argue, I think, perhaps rightly, that 10 days is an awfully long time. And we tell people, you should remove it immediately. You know, the moment someone tells you that they don't want your mail, you should stop sending it to them because you're only causing trouble.
The 10-day rule is perfectly reasonable for the 1960s where you've got big mainframe running COBOL. I think that's perfectly there. Someone's got to carry the tape from somewhere to somewhere else. I can't see how anything other than instantaneous is acceptable today.
I absolutely agree. Now, I know that part of the reason the 10 days initially came into play was because there were senders who often queue things up, you know, days in advance. And so it's already in the pipeline. And their concern was that they would, you know, people would then get something after opting out and suddenly they'd be in trouble under CAN-SPAM. But really that talks more to process than to the removal of the email address. And so even though, again, for that reason, you have these 10 days, you absolutely ought to be removing that email address from your mailing list immediately. Now, what this clarified, this new rule clarified, was not but how much time you have to do it, which stayed the same, but how onerous that removal request can be. And it can be not onerous at all. But the new requirement is that the act of opting out must only take a single action. So, for example, when I click on my, you know, the little link in your email that says unsubscribe, it must take me immediately to the unsubscribe. We would argue to the you have successfully unsubscribed page. In other words, we would argue, be counsel centers, you can't even, you definitely should not be asking for password. That's just not okay. You definitely shouldn't put an intermediate page that says, are you sure you want to unsubscribe? Here, let's tell you all the reasons why you shouldn't. And arguably, it shouldn't even be a page that says, you're about to unsubscribe, you want to confirm. You know, ideally, a single action means when I click unsubscribe in that email, I'm taken to a page that says you have successfully unsubscribed. So that page can say, if you didn't mean to, click here, but
yeah, I love this one where you have to log in to unsubscribe, and so then you've forgotten your username and password on that site, and then when you go to, when you try 20 different things to get it to work, then you go to the section where you unsubscribe and you can't find that in the user interface. That's great.
Absolutely. Or even better are the ones where you never even register a password. They just assign one to you that they never told you about. So this is to deal with all of those. Okay, right. Now, so those are pretty straightforward. However, this last one that I'm going to tell you about is the one that is just confounding. It is the most, now I have written legislation which I like to think is fairly straightforward. I always try and write in a way that while legally tight, you know, non-lawyer can understand. And I will be the first to decry, and have indeed done so, legislation that is just impenetrable. But I have to tell you that this new quote unquote clarification campaign is perhaps the most confusing, confounding, impenetrable piece of legislation I've ever seen. And so when end users and email senders look at it and run screaming, it's quite understandable because it took me several weeks through to really grok what it was saying. So here you go. And this, by the way, is up on our website. We have a very straightforward CAN-SPAM compliance page, which really breaks this down. And perhaps the best way to explain it is to explain what it's trying to avoid. You know those cases where you get email from someone? Let's say you get email from SureEmail.com. Okay, that's who sent it to you. And you look at the sender and you go, ah, SureEmail is sending an email. And you open the email, and the only thing in that email is a big old advertisement for FedEx. Right? Maybe FedEx paid us a bunch of money to say, hey, you know, you guys ensure it positively gets there in the inbox, and we positively sure, you know, get that mail packages there overnight, so there's synergy.
Solo mailing. That's called a solo mailing.
All right. Now, you're an end user. Who do you want to subscribe to?
I unsubscribe from the IFTP list.
Okay. Who do you think the average end user is going to try and unsubscribe to? Do you think they'll know? Do you think they'll look up that header, or are they going to see FedEx?
So the user wants to unsubscribe from the FedEx list.
Mm-hmm. Did you see how the confusion there? So this new rule with CAN-SPAM is to help address the confusion that things like that cause. So here's the rule. If you send email that contains advertisements for entities other than yourself, so third-party advertisements, one or more, it doesn't matter, you must also include some sort of advertising text for yourself in that same email.
See,
if you do that, let me finish. This is a tripartite rule. If you do that, if you be sure to include that text for yourself in the body of the email, you become what is known as the designated sender. So this is called designated sender rule. And you then are the designated sender for handling opt-out requests. If you fail to include in the text, the body of the email, something about yourself, then every advertiser who is advertised in that email is on the hook for handling opt-out requests.
Why are they so complicated when, let's say that I get the FedEx email from the ISIPB list, and there's just an unsubscribe link at the bottom. I just unsubscribe. I'm unsubscribed from your list. I never get solo mailings again, and so we've taken care of it. Why are they complicating the issue in that way?
That's a very good question, which I hope you will be able to ask someone else that you will interview that will be able to give you better insight there, other than to say that this is usually, well, you know that old saw about you should never watch sausage or legislation being made? And you can imagine that as these things were coming down the pike, and I'm sure you know that there are always hearings at which email senders, email service providers, ISPs, et cetera, all get to provide input. And then hopefully the legislative committee takes into account all that input. And I can only imagine, and I honestly don't know because I was not at those hearings, that they heard so many different conflicting things that this is their best effort to protect both the end users and the senders and the advertisers. Because, you know,
you have one more to explain this, don't you? So maybe if you can do that, because then I have some more questions around just the legal side of this. Maybe we can do that, just given our time constraint.
Well, actually, the fourth one was just sort of a reiteration as to who CAN-SPAM apply to, and that's to any and all commercial bulk mail. And what does that mean? That includes email for which a primary purpose is to feature or sell your own goods or services, even if you don't send that email yourself. And really, that second one goes to the McCain Amendment, which is what the legislation that's the part of GANFAN that I help author, which is a whole other area. But the fourth one really was, in fact, I was almost hoping that you wouldn't remember that I said four because it's really a non-issue. It just confirmed what was already in place.
Okay. So the point is, there's a clear issue around, we talked about this in several times, and I'm not real happy with the conversation we had because I don't get an answer that I really understand. There's a real problem with people being able to go to a site and sign up and have the privacy policy and in plain words say, you know, like an end user agreement says, okay, we now have permission to resell your email address to every single person we like, and they'll be sending you emails from lots of different addresses, and so therefore your email address is now done for because we're going to send you so much spam. It seems, given that the third point you highlighted in this law, that they're deliberately trying to enable this kind of stuff and all these solo mailings and everything else that happens. Why is all of this sort of stuff being enabled instead of just stopped?
I actually think that they're trying to just not disable it, but they're trying to make it very onerous, right? And here's the reason. As an email sender, if you are FedEx and you come to me and say, I want you to do the solo mailing, I know the headache that's going to ensue if it really is a solo mailing. I'm going to say no. And actually, probably you're not going to ask me to do it now because if it really is a true solo mailing and I am not featured anywhere in the content, the headache is on you now. The burden's on you, right? Because now you're going to be on the hook for all those unsubscribe requests as well as me. So I really think that this was an attempt to put controls on something that really had become out of control, as you pointed out, the potential there. I think it might have been not the best effort that could have come out of that. It might even be misguided, but I think that the intentions were pure. And I think really it was
To me, their intentions are really poor because it seems to me they're enabling something that shouldn't be allowed. Why aren't they just making some sort of rule that says if you want to have someone signing up for an address, the from address that mails will come from has to be clearly and conspicuously displayed. If you ever choose to display that, you may change that from address once a year, and then that's everything's very clear to everybody.
It's already the law that your from address has to be clear. So I think perhaps I didn't explain something wrong. Maybe you're thinking that this allows something it doesn't.
It allows retelling of data.
No, it shouldn't. I'm not following.
There's a big industry around this kind of thing where I can, let's say, everyone who joins up to my list, to Adrian's Media Innovators interview list, gets the interviews. I can have in my privacy policies, I also agree to, you'll be getting emails and you'll get automatically added to, and Mitchell's email deliverability list. So everyone automatically goes on to your list, plus 20 other different companies.
But the email that they'll get from Ann Mitchell's email deliverability list and will be from Ann Mitchell's email deliverability list, it won't be from Adrian Bye.
Right, but I'm legally allowed to resell all of my data to you.
That's why I said I think you took it to a different place. What I just talked about, the new law you described, does not address that at all and has nothing to do with that whatsoever.
Okay.
In fact, quite the opposite. This rule addresses when you take the list of people that you have and you don't tell it to me. Instead, you send an email advertising me. That's what that rule addresses.
Yeah, fair enough. I guess it's tied because that's how they're used, but that's, you know, the data then resold for these solo mailings. But yeah, take your point.
Let me just say that said, I absolutely agree with you 100%. And, we very strongly discourage and indeed will not accredit someone who has slippery privacy policies like that. And I would, in fact, the problem with those privacy policies, they have so much fine print, as you pointed out. Can I take just 1 second? I'm sorry, 10 seconds, less than 10. Can I read you our privacy policy? It's that short. The ISIP surety mail privacy policy is very simple. And I'm quoting now. We will not share your private information with anybody ever absent your permission or a court proceeding which compels us to produce such information, period. That's it. And you know what? That's what a privacy policy should look like.
Right.
So we're in complete agreement there.
Yeah, it's just that the FTC and the government isn't, and they're keeping and they're enabling a lot of this stuff. I mean, GANFAN came out a long time ago, and it's still there, so I don't get it. It seems like these guys are just on a different planet.
Well, you know, Adrian, the U.S., our email policies are all opt-out, and the EU and England, Britain in particular, have much more strident email policies that require, first of all, opt-in, and secondly, the penalty, their privacy policies, just that their national privacy policies are so much higher, and there is, there's a huge penalty to be exacted if you reveal someone's private data without their permission.
Okay. the other thing that I wanted to ask you about, it's just in general, and this is just back on the nod to ISIPP. If I didn't want to use ISIPP and just wanted to do things like, if I just wanted to do domain keys and I wanted to do STF, if I have my content right, domain keys and STF, is that going to get most of my mail through, or do I still need to have some sort of certification?
That's a good question, and there's not a straightforward answer for that, and that is it depends. And And that's because every ISP is different, every fan filter is different, and every mailing footprint is different. So the answer is absolutely yes, that could be all you need. It really depends on what you're sending out. Even if your content is completely right, it depends on your profile, how much you're sending out to how many people, the frequency, et cetera. And it depends on who you send to. You know, for example, some of our senders, their mailing lists are almost entirely Yahoo or AOL addresses, for example. And so in that case, what they need to focus on is very different than if their mailing list were primarily, people at enterprise, you know, B2B, for example. So it really depends, but it will certainly not hurt, and it could get you a large part of the way there. And also, you can stop, just for your own, your own sake of your tiredness of your mouth, you could stop saying ISIPP, you can just assure email, which is the name of the service. Isn't that easier?
Okay, fair enough. I've got a couple more quick questions. I've been asked with one mail service that I'm going to be using. They've said that to use their mail service, I have to use a subdomain through them or a domain through them. So they want to send the mail from their own domain so that then it's checked. But what they offer me as an alternative is to register my own domain and have, or a subdomain, so it could be mail.mydomain.com, and that would be exclusively used by them. They said that this is the only way to get mail delivered now, and if any service is mailing under your name, then their deliverability is going to be significantly worse. Is that correct?
Well, let me repeat what I think you said. So you were talking to an email service provider, right? And they're saying either, let's call them maildelivery.com. They're saying either you need to have your mail go out under adrian.maildelivery.com,
right,
or you can set up mail.adriansaddress.com, and that will be what they will use to send your mail out.
Exactly. Whereas other services will happily go along and use my email address as I specify, and it seems to work fine.
Okay. What they're saying, first of all, the piece that's missing there is undoubtedly the reason they're saying that is because they want to assign you your own IP address. And to assign you your own IP address, they need to give you a unique domain that goes with that IP address. Right?
But they're sending my app out from their domain, so it's either their domain or my own.
Right. You know, but they're almost certainly going to, they're almost certainly doing that by assigning you your own IP address. And they are absolutely right that that is the best way to ensure optimum deliverability. Is it the only way? No. But it is certainly a best way. Just as if you're sending your own email out, not through an email service provider, you will presumably be doing it through your own IP address. And as I mentioned earlier, really it's critical that if at all possible, you send your email out through a dedicated IP address that only you are using. So this email service provider is actually telling you truthfully what the best practices are. Now, it may be that that is the only way they will do business, and that's certainly their choice, and it would be one we would applaud, actually, because, again, it really is best practices. But it's certainly not the only way, and absolutely, you can go to other email service providers that will do it differently.
Okay, the last question that I wanted to ask about is for sending an email, let's say you send, and this is maybe not a small question, but maybe you can give us somewhat of a summary. If you send an email from your server to, you know, AOL, Hotmail, Yahoo, or Gmail, what are the current checks you know about that an email goes through to get into the inbox?
The first thing that happens is that the receiving server will make note of the IP address from which you're connecting, and it will do a series of checks on that IP address. The first thing it will do is look it up in all the different blacklists and see if you're listed there. And the second thing it may or may not do is look you up in the various accreditation services, such as ours, to see if you're listed with us. Then, and now I'm sort of aggregating. This is a combination of all the different things different ISPs do. Then they will check to make sure that you have RDNS, which is reverse DNS setup, and that means taking your IP address and seeing what domain claims to be serviced, or that IP address says it services. So it will check to make sure that your IP address resolves back to adrianmy.com. Then it will look at the email, the headers of your email, to see, okay, this IP address says it's adrianmy.com, so who does the email say it's from? And it will check to make sure that the mail is coming from the domain adrianmy.com. So, because, of course, spam would always spoof their email. So if, for example, your mail is claiming to be from adrianmy.com, but the IP address actually resolved to example.com, the other good your emails can either get bounced or blocked or go into the junk folder, because now you're sending email claiming to be one place, but really the IP address is another. Okay, you with me so far?
Yep.
Okay, that's all before their server ever accepts your email into their mail server. Once it passes all those checks, then it goes into content filtering. And that can mean actual words of phrases you're using. It can mean domains to check to see if you have links to domains that might be on blacklists because maybe someone is sending out a lot of spam advertising a particular domain.
At that level, I know one of the things that used to be able to whitelist mail was if it was from a friend who was already in your address book, and that would bypass all those filters, and therefore telefriend mail got through. Is that still the case, or is that not the case anymore?
No, and actually that's content filtering at the user level, so that would not before it got accepted into the server. There would be no way for that to be the case. Unless, now again, that depends on what you're talking about, mail that's hosted through an ISP or mail that's on your own mail server. Certainly you can put whatever rules you want in your own mail server, but I do not know of any ISPs that actually take their user's address book for whitelisting and put that out in front of the mail server. I mean, that just wouldn't even, no one would have
that. That makes sense. So that's called content. Fair enough. I didn't know that.
I'm just including that as part of content. In other words, right. You know, the whole header and body of email. Now, content typically has meant in the past, does it have the word Viagra in it? But, you know, or whatever. But in this context, I'm talking about everything from the headers down to the bottom of the email. You know, it's all text of one form or another, right? And it all, and the spam filters are all looking at what's in that text. So again, you know, it certainly can, when it gets to the point, well, let's get to that part in a minute. So it's looking at URLs that are in the text of the email, domains that are being advertised in the text of the email. It's looking at the from address. It's looking at even the to address. It's looking at the subject line, and it's looking at the overall content of the body. It's looking at the HTML to text ratio. It's looking at the image to text ratio. It's looking at the size of the font in the HTML, and it's looking at all the words in the body of the email. All of those things are being analyzed by probably, at this point, all of the ISPs in one way or another, and all of those things can determine whether you get delivered now to the inbox or to the junk folder. Once you've already been accepted into the mail server, your mail is usually going to go to one of those two places, either to the inbox or to the junk folder. Now, that's where your whitelisting based on the from address comes into play. Does it go to the inbox because you've whitelisted that address, or does it go to your junk folder? Now, the other thing that some of the ISPs and spam filters, particularly ISPs, are looking at now is your open rates and your click-through rates. So if you send 500,000 emails, you know, run 500,000 emails to many, many people, and if not many of them are getting opened, then you're going to start going to junk folder because the ISP is going to say, well, if our users...
They're putting a pixel track opens in there. I guess they can easily see whether the user's open. And then are they clicking the click-through URL so they can see whether people click on stuff?
I can't comment on that, and I do not know of any ISPs that are openly doing that. But I do know that there is the ability to track a click-through. Now, again, I have to caution to say that when it comes to open rates and click-throughs, we're talking about what now? We're talking about places where you go to their site to look at your email, because that's really the only way they could track it. They certainly can't track it once it's been downloaded from their server onto your computer.
Right.
That's one of the reasons that we caution our, you know, we work very closely with our accredited senders on these things to make sure that they understand the ramifications. You know, it used to be you just didn't really care about open rates except that, you know, it was something you could advertise to your customer, come with us because we have great open rates. But now you really need to care about those because they can affect your deliverability. And so really all this really means is you need to care that what you're sending isn't junk. You need to make sure that what you're sending your users want and that it's compelling so that they actually want to look at it. And if it isn't, then you shouldn't be sending it anyway.
When you talk about the first round of checks and you're in the accreditation part, if an email is accredited, will that then bypass a lot of content checks, or does it still go through the same rigmarole?
It really depends on the spam filter or the ISP to what extent they do dispense with all the other checks. In some cases, it doesn't go through any of the other checks. As soon as they see that your IP address is listed with us, it goes right to the inbox. In other cases, it's given weight so that they see that you're listed with us and then they look at all the other things. And that's because some ISPs, and certainly I don't blame them for this, or spam filters will say, well, you know, but what happened if a spammer puts one over on Surety Mail or over on Return Pass? What happens if that happens? Now, the ISPs all know, as in know, that if that were ever to happen, we would immediately, you know, summarily execute the spammer, by which I mean we would terminate their services. But that doesn't mean that that wouldn't have already come through. And so some ISPs are very ultra careful and say, you know, we really trust Surety Mail, but we're still just going to check to make sure that the content doesn't look too spammy. If it does, then we're going to look a little more closely at it and see. And you know, the odds are good that because of the way they give us, that it will still go to the inbox. But that's why I say it really depends on the ISP or spam filter. They all do it differently. But at the end of the day, it still means that you're going to go to the inbox. Or, because of course, no one can guarantee that 100% of your email will always go to the inbox because the ISPs and spam filters change their algorithms daily, sometimes hourly. So what it means is either if you're accredited with us, your email will go to the inbox, or if for some reason it doesn't, we're going to go to bat for you to rectify that and make sure it does then go to the inbox.
How about if someone wants to sign up with your service, how might they do that? How much does it cost?
In fact, we have many free resources at the site as well. So you can go to suretymail.com, and that's SuretyMail, suretymail.com. Although you so kindly said ISIPT so many times that they might be ingrained in their head, and they can also go to ISIPT.com, and all webs leads run there. And again, there we have many free things, very free resources there for you, whether you sign up with us for accreditation or not, but you can certainly sign up there for email accreditation, and the cost will depend on your business model. We actually have a unique pricing structure because we wanted to make sure that everyone could afford this. And so rather than basing pricing on volume, for example, which other places may do, it really depends on what your business model is, and that way it's affordable for everybody.
Cool. Okay, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you ever so much. It's always a pleasure, Adrian.